Happy to be joined by one of our favorites, Bobby Marks, front office insider, NBA on ESPN. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's going rather well. Why don't you? Why don't we start with what we were just talking about and Dwayne Casey taking the 5-year deal to go to the Detroit Pistons? Do you see much hope for that franchise in the next half decade?
I do. I mean, it's a different situation than Orlando or Charlotte, where or maybe even more just Orlando, where you're more of a rebuild. I think Detroit is kind of an already made product with little flexibility. But, the upside is that you've got Blake for another year, and hopefully that Reggie Jackson stays healthy. I think the big key will be is what does Dwayne get out of the younger players, the Stanley Johnson, Henry Ellison, Luke Kennard group. Maybe he can find the same success what he did with the former first-round picks in Toronto. I think that's going to be probably his biggest task, just based on where they are heading into free agency, probably limited with money to go out and sign a players. They don't have their first-round pick. It was traded to the Clippers. So it's an interesting situation. Is it a playoff team? Possibly. Do I see it jumping up into that Philadelphia, Boston, I guess Toronto, Cleveland if LeBron stays, category? I don't right now.
Yeah, that's the only reason why I don't look at it as a very good job is, hey, listen, it's an NBA coaching job. There's only so many, so I think you got to take it, especially when they extend you a 5-year deal. The limited flexibility with the cap and who you can sign, the problems with the roster, especially with the lack of wing players and lack of guards, is definitely troubling. And yeah, when you don't have picks and you don't have any exciting young players, considering what Casey has done with younger players in the past, it'd be nice to have him be able to work with some. But yeah, when you say a guy like Henry Ellenson and he's in your top three, like that's not that doesn't sound overly appealing to me. But hey,
they're gonna need Henry Ellenson. I mean, as much, I know we're it doesn't excite probably Pistons fans right now, but they're gonna need him to kind of play a role and not really be a project. And the same with Stanley and Luke too. I think a lot of what happened with, the downfall of that Pistons front office is, maybe some missed opportunities with, Devin Booker and Donovan Mitchell and some, but a lot of people missed out on those guys. And it's going to be a huge summer of development for those players.
So it's going to be a huge summer all over the NBA because, of course, we have LeBron watch and there's a little bit of rumbling still about Kawhi Leonard. And, of course, now Kyrie Irving is popping into this. Paul George has to sign somewhere. The NBA offseason is just – like it treats us to no end. And I want to ask you a question. We saw this on a Twitter account. I think it was Bleacher Report earlier today. And the question is, what's the worst thing that can happen during this NBA offseason?
What's the worst thing that can happen? Doesn't make a decision until August. I'll probably be divorced by then. And I'll run out of clean clothes in Bristol. That would probably be the worst. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the worst would probably be him going to Golden State and the Warriors not having giving up anything to sign him, and he's willing to take a significant discount. You would probably see the league step in and do what they did with A-Rod in Major League Baseball, 15 years ago when he tried to get into the Red Sox. And I guess that would be the worst thing there. I mean, everything else, I've talked about LeBron a lot, and we're still 3 weeks away, but for him, it really comes down to Cleveland, Philly, and the Lakers, and anything else after that, the Cavaliers will have a huge role in where he ends up. And I say that because Houston, Miami, San Antonio, I guess we can throw Boston in the mix. Teams that are over the cap, James would have to basically force a trade, and there's no say that Dan Gilbert or Kobe Altman, their general manager, would actually do a deal to facilitate James, especially to keep him in the East. So I think we're still in a little bit of an early stages here. We got to figure out if he's going to opt in or opt out of that contract there. But yeah, I mean, I think if we're talking about the worst thing that could happen, it would probably be him going to Golden State and without them giving up, a Klay Thompson or a Draymond Green type player.
Yeah, that'd be bad. I mean, it would be interesting, but it would definitely be bad for the league.
And I gotta say, I'd be more interested in that than him staying in Cleveland at this point.
Maybe. I think there's an argument to be made. I'm interested though, Bobby, when you're talking about the potential of him opting in and then a trade being facilitated by Kobe Altman and Dan Gilbert. I mean, LeBron still holds the cards, right? Like he could become a free agent. Don't you think if it's between that and actually getting something of value in a trade, that would be enough to convince them to do kind of the Chris Paul thing?
I think it's certainly it's something they should consider because you lose him for nothing. You're still over the cap, so it's not like all of a sudden you have $40 million to go out and sign players. It helps you in 2019 when money starts coming off the books. I think it's a matter of what players do you get back. Are they assets? Are you willing to take back money and be in a luxury tax? Because I'm sure there's a scenario out there where Daryl Morey in Houston would trade you a Ryan Anderson and a P.J. Tucker and Eric Gordon. But what does Ryan Anderson do for Cleveland? So that's where you start looking for third teams out there. And what will happen this summer, and this is the challenge, because unlike 2016 when we had, 26 or 27 teams with room and significant room, there's only going to be 7 or 8 teams that have cap space. So how do you find an Atlanta or Phoenix or Dallas, Chicago, teams that are rebuilding to be a dumping ground for contracts, but will also, you also have to probably catch a draft pick. So that's going to be what Cleveland is going to have to weigh in. And we'll find out in a couple of weeks as far as what James does with that option.
Well, yeah, if LeBron ends up leaving Cleveland, they're just in such an impossible position, right? Because you're still looking at a luxury tax team, one that's got a whole bunch of bad contracts in the books, but they're not going to be able to really compete, and so they can't exactly give up draft picks to get out from underneath any of those, right?
Well, you're right, and I wrote about him. We haven't published it yet, and I kind of went through what happens if he does leave, and then I think you start seeing the domino effect, and I think you probably start focusing on Kevin Love as far as he would be going into, I guess technically his last year of his contract. He's got a player option to 2019-20 as far as what the value of Kevin would be, but I mean, you're stuck with some not appealing contracts. You've got George Hill for another year at, 18, 19 million. Tristan Thompson is under contract for 2 more years. JR is under contract for, $14 million cap hit. Korver's still there. What are you going to do with Rodney Hood, who was, besides, I guess, game three and four, really didn't do much for you in the playoffs? Those are going to be the decisions. You are a team that will be in the lottery, but you don't have your draft pick in 2019. It goes to Atlanta if it falls outside the top 10. So it is not an appealing situation. If James leaves, it's a lot different than when he left in 2010. I mean, you don't have a Kyrie Irving kind of waiting in the wings the following year.
Yeah, and it's not as though, what do they pick, 8th? It doesn't seem anyways that there's going to be a transcendent player there. You might get lucky with like a Michael Porter Jr. and he stays healthy, he stays in that slot, maybe he becomes something, but it doesn't appear anyways that there's 8 guys in this draft that are somebody's going to fall to you that's going to be a superstar.
I think there's a cutoff probably at 6.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where you're looking at it when you include Luka Doncic, the Slovenian guard, and then you add all the bigs, with DeAndre Ayton from Arizona, Mo Bamba from Texas, Wendell Carter and Marvin Bagley from Duke, Jaren Jackson from Michigan State. I think that's kind of your 6. And then you've got players like, Trae Young from Oklahoma, Colin Sexton from Alabama, both Bridges, McHale from Villanova and Miles from Michigan State, in that group there. So there is a little bit of a drop off once you get past 6, and you could put Michael Porter from Missouri in there. And I think Porter would be a top 4 pick, but there's just so much uncertainty missing the whole year. And, with his back there.
So how big a problem is it that we've had you on for a little over 10 minutes now, and we still haven't even talked about the NBA finals?
Well, I think it's a problem where we've seen these teams 4 years in a row, and the likelihood is we probably won't see this again. And I know everybody screams at competitive balance here, but the reality was that we were probably a Chris Paul hamstring injury away from seeing probably a different team in the finals and probably having a different champion this year. But we didn't, and we see a dominant Golden State team that can turn it on whenever they choose to please, and they don't need all their 4 guys to be clicking on all cylinders, for them to get past a team like Cleveland.
Yeah, so you believe that, right? That Chris Paul, because I believe what you said, the second part of that, that they can just turn it on whenever, and that if Chris Paul plays in that game seven, that they play well enough to beat him either way, that they just do enough to win. But you believe that if Chris Paul plays in that game seven, we are talking about the Houston Rockets being in an NBA Finals.
I think they're, I mean, I don't want to, I'd never want to discount Golden State having their backs against the walls, because we've seen it before them win big games in, you know, in Oklahoma City a couple of years ago. But yeah, I mean, I just liked how that Rocket team was playing up until that Paul injury. You know, you go in there, I thought they had a little, you know, a sense of toughness. There was an identity there. And I think he is certainly, you know, an all-NBA player. He's a difference maker. And you remove him for two games, that is a huge impact. So I guess we'll never know. But I think there would have been a strong chance that we would have seen maybe Houston in an NBA Finals against Cleveland instead of Golden State had Paul stayed healthy.
Oh, while we're playing the theoretical game then, Bobby, what does the finals look like if LeBron James doesn't put his hand through that whiteboard at the end of game one? How much of an impact do you think that really did have on the rest of the series?
We'll probably four games. We're probably maybe talking about five games. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the impact there is. And I think that game one, although he did some damage to his hand, I think from a mental angle, that took a lot out of that Cleveland team, basically having that in the grasp of their hands, and then you know trying to win a game two, and then your margin for errors is so small there. And so yeah, I don't know if James, what he did in game post game in game one would have had much of an impact if we're still talking about a game six, maybe leading into a game, possibly game seven down later this week.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think his hand was obviously hurt. There's pictures of the swelling. I don't know if it was
necessarily. Saw him doing push-ups too.
Yeah, broken, as he said. Yeah, also the handshakes. Listen, I'm not trying to play like a detective here on how hurt he was. Clearly, like some of the numbers, the shooting numbers specifically, took a dip after the 51-point performance, but I mean, that tends to happen when you score 51 and have a brilliant game the way he did. I'm sure he was hurt. The cast seemed a little bit much, but I don't think it changed the series. And I think that's what's a little bit frustrating here, right, is that it's not just that we've seen the same thing four times in a row, because, again, some of those games were really fun, and game one was really entertaining, and we got a few solid moments in this series. I think what's been a little frustrating is that even if you do look at that Rocket series and say, okay, well, the Rockets could have won, a lot of that was just that the Warriors didn't seem engaged at times, and they were sloppy, and they didn't play their best brand of basketball. And watching them throughout this entire final, throughout these entire finals, there were so few moments of where you felt like, oh man, this is the incredible dominant Warriors team that we all expected. And that, I think the point was made by Andrew Sharp, who's joining us later today, that it takes away from both Curry and Durant when, you know, they don't need to have those transcendent performances like we saw from KD in game three to get by, that it's just like, okay, yeah, we can out-talent you and we'll beat you even though we're not at our best. And they don't even look that interested in doing it. Like the way they celebrated their finals victory. And again, I don't want to play overly like body language doctor here, but they were like, yeah, routine. And Steve Kerr is like, yeah, we expected this. And everyone's like, oh, okay, great. And if you're not breaking up this year, you're not breaking up anytime soon. And I guess like that's the frustrating element to me, is that this is happening so easy for them, and that the level of care even for them seems to be middling at best.
Well, I think you're right. And I think that goes back to, you know, the summer with free agency. And there are a lot of great storylines, you know, LeBron James, Paul George, Chris Paul, DeMarcus Cousins, players like that. But I mean, even if LeBron James and let's say Paul George go to the Lakers together, they're not the first or the second best team in the West. I mean, they're not. I mean, it's the reality of the situation is wherever LeBron James goes this summer doesn't really move the needle as far as where that team gets to compete from a finals or trying to dethrone Golden State. I mean, in Los Angeles, I don't know what I'm going to get from Brandon Ingram or Kyle Kuzma or Lonzo Ball in the offseason. Those guys have never played in the playoffs before. Or if I try to force a trade to Boston, well, the likelihood it will probably cost you Gordon Hayward and Jaylen Brown. So then you start, you know, taking pieces away here. And, you know, that Warrior team, I've said all year, you get that team to you know, April, May, or June in one piece, I don't see a team beating them. And Houston came, necessarily came close to it, but the group returns another year. Nobody is departing. You'll get a pick in the draft and you'll have, you know, you'll be limited in flexibility, but I expect us to be talking about Golden State, you know, a year from now, unless something, you know, drastic happens.
Yeah, I agree. And that kind of brings us to how you feel about them as a dynasty, and I guess how you feel about Kevin Durant, mm-hmm. because he gets the back-to-back finals MVP. It is extremely rarefied air, and there's no question that his Game 3 was a signature performance. It was an incredible performance. I still don't know if I look at the Warriors, and I can say maybe they're the greatest team of all time or that they're at least up there, but I still don't evaluate these championships the same way. And unfairly, as unfair as it may be for Kevin Durant, I just don't look at those back-to-back finals MVPs the way that I do with the players that have done it before him. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a dynasty standpoint, I think from a team level, you know, 3 out of 4 years is hard to do, and we haven't seen that in a long time here. I understand the Durant factor, basically, you know, from 2016, joining a team that had won, you know, what, 73 games there. But the likelihood is that he was joining that team, you know, with or without a cap spike, and they would have figured out how to get him, and you know, maybe it would have cost the Iguodala probably. Well, probably Sean Livingston here. So, yeah, I understand the, I guess, the Durant rationale where you add Kevin to this group already, and it didn't really cost you. It cost you Harrison Barnes and Andrew Bogut to do so, and it become, you know, this dynasty in waiting. But I think it's a little bit different than maybe the Bulls dynasties, you know, of the 90s. I mean, those are two different teams, but you still had – you know, it wasn't like you added, you know, Patrick Ewing for the 95-96 team or one of those, or Karl Malone there, an all-NBA player. Yes, you got Dennis Rodman, but I understand how people look at this Golden State team, and there is some, you know, certainly some skepticism as far as from a dynasty standpoint.
Yeah, and I get a little upset when Steve Kerr's like, it was so hard. Oh, this season was the hardest.
Or when their owner is coming out and saying, actually, was it their owner or their general manager today saying, like, I felt that the rest of the league felt upset with me when we signed Kevin Durant.
Yeah,
like,
it was the owner. It was Joe Lacob. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But before we let you go, Bobby, I would love to get your thoughts on what seems like the two remaining Raptors head coaching candidates. It looks like it's down to Nick Nurse and Ettore Messina of the San Antonio Spurs. If you had to rank the two as their likelihood of being the next head coach of the Raptors, how would you put it?
I would think I would give Nick a little bit of an advantage just from a familiarity standpoint with the roster. I think it will be important to see what happens with Dwayne Casey as far as what coaches he is allowed to take with him to Detroit. I think it's important, you know, to, you know, of course, for Nick to retain as many as possible, just because there's been a working relationship with this group for, you know, what, seven or eight years here. So I think if you're trying to continue the same path or, you know, from where you were the last couple of years, I would certainly give, you know, I would give Nick an edge. But I am intrigued by Ettore, you know, Messina from San Antonio, just based on, you know, he's got a lot of international experience. He's got, you know, one of the greatest coaches in Greg Popovich that he's learned from. And we've seen a pretty good track record of Spurs coaches with, you know, Brett Brown in Philadelphia. We saw Mike Budenholzer in Atlanta for a time now in Milwaukee. And now we see James Borrego in Charlotte there. So I wouldn't see as much of a learning curve if Messina is the guy. But I think just looking at it, you know, from the outside, I think Nick would probably get a little bit of an advantage just based on the experience of being there already.
Bobby, we always appreciate the time. Hopefully for you, LeBron James makes a decision before August, so you can go on with your life.
Well, the earliest it's been is July 10th and 11th, so that's kind of where I have my, if I'm going to put a marker on the board right now, but anything after that, I might be in trouble.
You would be the person who adamantly supports the decision 2.0. He gives you a date, he tells you, like, yeah, listen, this is going to be it. Yeah. You would not be able to criticize with a straight face. You'd have to just be like, you know what, this is the right move for him and the right time for him, and I think the league appreciates it.
You got it.